week of September 20th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 21, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And outside of McDonald's in Cambridge, Ohio, I'm Michael Giltz.
That's right. Michael is on his way back from Toronto via New York and going to a million different places. So he actually pulled over on Interstate 70 to join us. That's how serious he takes this show. I know a lot of people have been writing in saying the shows have been running long, and we are going to try and cut them back and keep them down. Although, if you give us 60 minutes this week, you will certainly know a heck of a lot going on in the entertainment space. We have a ton of guests today, including Brill Bundy from ZapToIt.com. She's going to be here to talk about the Emmys. We have David Poland and Noel Murray. David Poland from Movie City News and Noel Murray from The Onion's AV Club. They're going to be joining Michael to talk about the Toronto International Film Festival, which just wrapped up over the weekend. We always try to start off by talking about the box office each week.
Yeah, cloudy with a chance of meatballs?
I'm sorry, are you doing the weather?
No, yes.
You obviously, I know you hate comics, cartoons, as you say, but I'm very glad it's a very good film. Sony should be happy. It's $30 million. They were hoping for, you know, there was in line with expectations, but I've seen some negative second guessing saying this movie really should have been at $40, $50 million given the good reviews it got. And it is a very good film. A friend of mine loves it. I liked it, even though I was exhausted when I saw it at midnight in Chelsea with five gay men. So it was not the best audience. It was an empty theater. And, you know, you want to see it at noon with a bunch of kids, not at midnight. But I was very impressed by it. A lot of fun visuals. You can take in, you can take children to it. Adults will enjoy it on their own. I'm looking forward to seeing it again to see, you know, it might even be one of my favorites of the year. But it's definitely a good, good, fun film.
Well, of course, it's also it was released both in 2D and 3D. It's a Sony Imageworks production. Sony Imageworks has been trying to break into the family market for the past several years unsuccessfully. They had a movie called an animated film called Surf's Up, which didn't do very well, although it was a pretty funny film. But there was an article in the Los Angeles Times over the weekend about Sony's lack of success at breaking into the family market with animated films.
Their first movie was Open Season, and that did quite well. And then they did flounder a bit with Surf's Up, which is unfortunate because it had good reviews, and it was just a little bit of an odd duck, I guess. But, you know, they haven't really gotten up to speed yet. It's like three films over, like, 6 years, I think, something like that, or 4 years. And this is a movie without any big names attached to it. It is attached to a book that it's based on, but it's not a huge property as a book. So, you know, they were starting from scratch, I think, and it's a lot of fun. I think it's going to have great legs, and it's definitely going to do tremendously well on DVD.
Well, that'll be interesting because I just spent the last week I was at IBC, speaking at IBC regarding 3D content, and then I flew home on Tuesday and spent the rest of the week at the Universal Hilton at the 3D Entertainment Summit. And that's the big question is, will these films, these 3D films, do well on video? And apparently, 3D televisions are just around the corner. Apparently, by the middle to end of next year, you're going to be walking into Best Buy or your local electronics store and seeing televisions that have the little sticker on it that say 3D capable.
Well, I tell you, I won't be one of those people buying them.
We should actually try and get somebody on who is a little bit more, I don't want to say positive about it, but certainly is somebody who's
and
working on it.
Who can be informed and really tell us why we want this and why audiences within 5 years would want this. Because otherwise, I really...
But I'm not buying a new piece of equipment. They want me to spend another $2,000 on a TV. It's not happening.
So here's an interesting fact, though, and the reason why 3D films are kind of the flavor of the month, if you will. They are making Hollywood incremental revenue. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs had 127 screens that were in IMAX, and they accounted for an estimated $2.5 million. And I would imagine that 3D, with the higher ticket price that you get for 3D, that a large percentage of the $30 million was 3D tickets.
Well, you're confusing me, but I mean, obviously, if the movie's in 3D, you don't want to see it in 2D, but I didn't go see Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs because it's in 3D. I went to see it because it got really good reviews. A friend saw it and said it was good, and if it was in 2D, I would have seen it anyway. I didn't say, oh, I've got to see this 3D movie. That's where Hollywood has got its head up its ass. If it's a good movie, I'll go see it. If it's a bad movie, I won't go see it. I don't care if it's in 10D. So, you know, I didn't. I was not drawn to this.
Wow.
Well, actually, that is exciting. I was not drawn to this movie because it was in 3D. In fact, I'm annoyed more and more when I walk to the theater and they think they can charge an extra $3 on top of the huge ticket prices I'm already paying just for the pleasure of seeing the movie they want me to see.
Well, nearly $18 million of the opening for Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs was from 3D presentation. So I was right. What I was trying to say is that half of that $30 million was probably from 3D ticket sales, and indeed that is true.
What are you saying?
That more than half of the $30 million made by Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs in its opening weekend, half of the box office or more came from 3D ticket sales, and that's exactly the case.
Are most of the screens it was on 3D?
No, that couldn't.
What's the breakdown?
I'd have to go in and figure that
out.
Yeah,
no, I mean, we know that when it's a 3D movie, most people are going to want to see it in 3D. In fact, I avoided going to the theater in Brooklyn showing it in 2D because what's the point, you know?
It opened on 4,500 screens, so 4,500 mm-hmm. screens in North America, and it screened in 3D at 1,828 different theaters. So that is less than 50%.
Yeah, but as we know, the vast majority of money on a movie is made on that first 1,500 screens. Those 1,800 screens are the prime screens. I've seen estimates. There was a Variety article about how 90% of the movie's income come from like the first 1,500 screens, and that extra 2,000 screens accounts for like 5% of the income. They open movies way wide. It's just so they can boast. It's not necessary. They're wasting all this money on prints, which is why, you know, digital cinema will be a good thing for them. You can make $80 million on 1,500 screens. You do not need to be on 4,000 screens. It's just an illusion and a number. It's a multiplex in a small town where it's on five screens and the other four is just malarkey. So those 1,800 screens are the best screens in the biggest markets in the biggest cities at the best cinemas.
Actually, I would have to say after 2 weeks of sitting through 3D conferences that the 3D screens in most movie theaters are not on the best screen in the house. They are in kind of a medium-sized screen because they have to play through.
Yeah, but you're talking about a technical thing. I'm saying that the best theaters in the best cities are getting the 3D movie. It's Podunk, Oklahoma that has a 2D copy, and it's Brooklyn in a smaller theater that has the 2D Cloudy Chances of Meatballs. The prime location in Manhattan all had the 3D cinemas. The top grossing cinemas have that movie in 3D. It's the location of the theater. I'm not talking about the screen versus screen 8 versus screen 4. You know, the 3D movies are shown at the top-grossing movie theaters in the top-grossing cities and locations in the country. College towns with tons of kids and all that stuff.
Actually, you know what? I would say that since Carmike Cinemas, a movie theater circuit here in the United States, it's the fourth largest or fifth largest circuit in the United States, and is
known... That's way down.
Yeah, well, it's known for having venues in third-tier markets and, you know, basically...
Carmike is a third-tier chain. That's the fifth-largest chain is way down the chain.
Yes, but they have the most 3D projectors or 3D-capable projectors of any circuit out there, and that's been the
problem. They only have 250 theaters
okay.
in the whole country.
Okay!
Sorry, but they have 250 theaters in the entire country. Carmike is a podunk little chain. Carmike is saying you're the fifth-ranked theater chain is like saying you're the fifth-ranked TV network. That makes you CW, and you have 2 million people watching Gossip Girl. Who gives a damn?
Well, because they have 500 3D-capable screens.
Because Gossip Girl's a really good show.
Okay, moving on. In a 2D movie that didn't do very well is The Informant. I heard mixed reviews about it before it came out, and now I have people seeing it, friends of it, who really like it. I didn't get to see it this week, and I saw Cloudy, which was a lot of fun. Did either of you see The Informant?
I did not.
I think it looks really bad.
Kenneth Turan ripped it a new fill in the blank.
It looks like a cross between like The Talented Mr. Ripley, maybe a little Jason Bourne, but maybe that's just because Matt Damon is in it. I don't know what to make of it.
It's a comedy. It's not a serious thriller at all.
Satire. But the thing that's so weird is that like the script wasn't written that way. That was Soderbergh's choice to direct it that way.
No. Really?
Yeah.
I heard the original radio story that this whole movie was based on over the weekend. It was a story on This American Life, which is a show on National Public Radio here in the United States. And it's a fantastic, phenomenal piece. It's an hour long. You should look it up. Maybe we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And I haven't seen the film, but the film has a lot to live up to.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. And if I don't know what to make of it, it doesn't get my $12.
Well, it came in second, made $10.5 million on 2,500 screens. The budget for the film is reportedly $22 million, so it looks like it's going to make its money back.
Wow, they really made it for $22 million? Matt Damon must have a piece on the back end.
Who knows? A person we know who has it.
We know who has a back end?
Was it Medea? Medea has a big back end?
Yeah, where are you moving on with this?
I'd say Medea has a big back end. Go with that.
Well, what I was trying to say before I was so rudely interrupted by myself was Tyler Perry's I Can Do Bad All By Myself came in third with $10 million. It dropped
57%. Can I just say that when I saw this poster, I thought I Can Do Bad All By Myself was the tagline. And I looked at it and I'm like, what's this movie called?
Well, just to finish off on because we do have to get to our guests, just to finish off box office, Love Happens opened this week.
Or didn't, I should say.
Oh, I'm so bummed. I wanted to like that. Even though I can't stand Jennifer Aniston, I wanted to like it and go see it. And then I read all the reviews. I was like, oh, I don't even know if that's a Netflix.
Yeah, it's a romantic comedy starring Jennifer Aniston and Aaron Eckhart. It made $8.45 million over the weekend on 1,898 screens. Jennifer's Body opened in fifth place, $6.8 million. That's a Toronto film, and we'll probably be talking about that later in the show. It opened in fifth place on 2,700 screens. You know, the only other noteworthy news here in box office is Inglourious Basterds made another $3.6 million. It dropped 41%. It dropped nearly 700 screens as well, so it's on 2,500 screens. It has made $109.9 million, so it is now the top grossing Quentin Tarantino film of all time.
Yes. And also, and 500 Days of Summer continues to chug along. It's now at $36 million. I bet this buddy gets one of the 10 Oscar slots. I hope it keeps getting momentum, but it's just chugging along. It's a real leggy word of mouth hit. It's really nice to see.
Okay. And a quick ode to Patrick Swayze. What was your favorite Patrick Swayze movie or TV appearance?
Well, this week I was kind of channel surfing. And I went from Point Break to Dirty Dancing to Youngblood. Like it was one channel after another on these.
Well, they know what they're doing. For me, it would have to be, I think his best movie is Point Break. Roadhouse is stupid fun. Dirty Dancing is iconic. Ghost is a huge hit. But the one I would actually enjoy is Point Break. That's a fun sly thriller by Kathryn Bigelow, who, of course, is in theaters with The Hurt Locker. Another very good movie.
I'm going to go with The Outsiders. I don't even know if he starred in that, but I'm just going to throw it in there just in case.
He was in it. That's good enough. I'm going to go with North and South. When I first discovered
Patrick Swayze. The miniseries. Oh, my God. Yeah. I forgot that.
So good.
Good choice. And The Outsiders has one of the great casting jobs of Hollywood history.
Yeah.
Absolutely an unbelievable casting job. That is just a one for the record books.
And, of course, Karen, the reason you're bringing that up is, unfortunately, on Tuesday of this past week, Patrick Swayze passed away from cancer.
Yeah, and this is news for everybody who is out there in space. Our space age news.
Yeah, correct. And that's why we're not really going to cover it in any great detail, because at this point it's already, while a big story, it's been covered to death. What we should be covering.
Is it rude to say? I don't even know if it's a big story. I understand why it made a lot of news and for a day or two you talk about it, but you know, it's
on the cover of all my magazines. I think that makes it a big story.
What we should be covering instead, of course, is the Emmys, which happened
last night. Yes, okay, I subscribe to Us Weekly.
That implies John and Kate is a big story, too, and I'm not quite willing to go there yet. But anyway.
Well, the Emmys...
Speaking of television.
I'm trying to segue. This is just not happening, is it?
Off to the Emmys. Get our guest.
Let's go get Brill Bundy on the phone here. I'm going to give her a call. She's going to be joining us by phone. Hold on just a second. And okay. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles is Brill Bundy, the managing editor for ZapToIt.com. Brill has been covering the television industry and television itself for the last 14 years. At one point, she had a podcast called Brill and Eric Watch TV. What happened to that podcast?
Basically time. Just not enough time to keep it up.
We understand that.
Yes, indeed. But of course, the reason we wanted to talk to you today is because the Emmy Awards were last night, and Mad Men and 30 Rock repeated their wins as Best Drama and Best Comedy.
They did, and I think that was expected, whereas the rest of the acting awards were a lot more of a mixed bag in terms of winners.
What surprised you the most?
I would say probably Cherry Jones for Supporting Actress.
I was thrilled with that because I thought she was great and I thought it was one of their best seasons.
I thought she was great too. I don't think it just seemed like a very surprising. I think it seemed sort of like the voters were kind of over 24. I also thought Kristen Chenoweth was surprising, since Pushing Daisies was canceled, and I thought she might have faded from memory, even though I think she was fantastic.
Can we just talk about Kristen Chenoweth for a second? Because I do think that the reason she was she won was because that show is canceled. But I also, what was the deal with all those glasses that all of those actresses were wearing? That was the first award handed out, and everybody was wearing weird glasses except for Vanessa Williams, who just looked at the camera and went, absolutely not. No way.
I thought that was wonderful. Yeah, what's the story there?
Well, I think they were, you know, they were, I think it was a setup gag of, you know, with supporting actresses for comedy. I don't think, a lot of people took it as, oh, Vanessa Williams is too good to play along, except I think if you go with her Ugly Betty character, that's exactly how she would have reacted of, I'm not going to, you know, play along with this. So I think it was all just sort of a setup.
What did you think about Toni Collette winning?
I thought that was great. I think United States of Terror is fantastic. I've always really liked Toni Collette as an actress. She's like really one of those fearless actresses who will go anywhere. So I thought she was a really well-deserved win. I don't think any, you know, I would say, don't want to say that John Cryer didn't deserve to win. I just have a personal bias and hate 2.5 Men so much that I thought that was kind of a surprise win, although probably if you think the mainstream case that most of the Academy has, it probably wasn't.
But yeah,
and
I would have loved to have
Harris.
Seen Neil Patrick Harris win. Yeah, he exactly. really deserves yeah. it. Or even, you know, the guy from Big
Rain
Bang
Wilson?
Theory. Whose name I always forget. No, I'm so over Rain Wilson.
Except I think Jim Parsons, wasn't he up for lead actor?
Yeah, exactly. That's the lead role.
My bad. They all start blending together, don't they?
Yeah, I know, exactly.
And what did you think of Neil Patrick Harris? The reviews are generally very positive.
I think he was fantastic. I thought that, you know, I thought the whole show for an award show was really well done. I did not have any incredibly cringeworthy moments except for Sarah McLachlan singing during the, you know, memorial thing, because whenever she has that animal rights commercial and Save the Animals, just it gnaws at me so much that I really want to like go kick a puppy, because she's just so irritating. It's like it has the exact opposite reaction for me. It's just like, no, I'm not going to go get a stray just because of her.
Well, I mean, she has a beautiful voice, and of course the song is beautiful, but I also thought it was like too on the nose for that particular
right.
segment. I mean, she sang I Will Remember You, I believe is the name of the song.
Yeah.
And she sang it, of course, over the montage of everybody who has been lost or who has passed away in the past year, including Patrick Swayze and Larry Gelbart, who passed away within the last 2 weeks. And it was just too pat. It was too cliche. Now, what did you think of the whole control room being behind the stage there?
I thought that worked.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, and I love John Hodgman. I thought that was like just a brilliant to have him as the color commentator.
He was great, but he's always great.
Exactly, but it was something, you know, they tried something different, which I think that's an area where, you know, they really could have so easily just been like, okay, there'll be the announcer who guides people to the stage and fills the dead air, but they took it that little extra step.
What should the Oscars look at and say, we should copy this? Or what should other award show learn from this show?
Neil Patrick Harris.
Exactly. I think this was how the Emmys won this time, is they didn't take it too seriously. They made it a really enjoyable evening where the Oscars just kind of seemed so self-important. And this did not seem self-important.
Well, I'm just jealous that you and Corby got to sit and watch the telecast live in Los Angeles at 5 o'clock in the evening instead of at 8 o'clock when the rest of us bozos had to watch it.
Well, we were in the LA Times. We our offices are in the LA Times building, so we were through the East Coast feed of that. So we were in a newsroom. So that was really not that exciting. We weren't actually at the awards.
Oh, well, Sperling, let's get her off then.
that 3 hours, it's like, yeah, it's great. My husband was very annoyed because he was at home and he was like, okay, I have to stay off Twitter because I can't watch it till 8.
Right. Well, and I watched it starting at 9 because I put it on TiVo so that I could fast forward through all the commercials, which half the time I forgot to do. But I was sitting there at like 5:30, 6 o'clock watching Corby and yourself on Twitter going, I can't believe I did this to myself. I never should have turned Twitter on.
But I agree. That's sort of my thing with the Oscars. It's like Oscars is the only award show that airs live on the West Coast at like 5. And I think they should do it for all of the award shows. I don't think that the Oscars is special in that. I think all of the award shows should be aired live.
Except what do they do then if you're CBS, which was the network that aired the Emmys last night? What do you do during prime time? Do you just re-air the Emmys again?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's like they manage these sort of things with like the Super Bowl, you know, they have these contingency plans. I think they can work it out.
Yeah.
Show 60 minutes after the show rather than before. Well, and as you guys know, the show was a success in the ratings. It had an uptick after several years of record low ratings. It increased in all the important categories. And it was a ratings winner and certainly looks good for Neil Patrick Harris. And, of course, this is the week that the Jay Leno show premiered, and it also did very well in the ratings. It certainly got sampled on Monday. The first show was seen by 18 million people, on Tuesday by 11 million, on Wednesday by 13 million, and Thursday and Friday it hovered around 8 million, 9 million viewers. What did you think of the Jay Leno show for its first week?
Yeah, I think the first week was really pretty much what they expect. I don't think you can at all judge it on the first week, especially since, you know, this week is when most of the new show and returning shows come back. I thought over the summer, Kevin Riley from Fox was very magnanimous when he said, look, you know, there's not, on some nights, there's just not a lot of competition in the 10 o'clock hour. Leno will probably do fine. And I think my big complaint about Leno is that it's very short-sighted of NBC. You know, they're looking for a number they can count on, but they're not putting money and resources and development into something that could be a breakout in that hour. And I think they're just keep, you know, watering down their product by doing that.
Well, when 30 Rock won, Tina Fey got up on stage and I believe thanked NBC for allowing her show to stay on the air and not deciding to put on some cheaper talk show.
This year.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. We won't know for a year what it shapes up like as far as the competition and how it does rating-wise, but quality-wise and creatively, what did you think of the show?
Yeah, I think it was fine. I've never been a Leno fan. You know, Leno, you know what you get with Leno. If you like it, you like it. If not, I think he lucked out the first night with Kanye West as a guest. You know, it's filler TV. It's if you have time to kill and nothing else is on, you can put it on, and it's almost like comfort food. I just think in this day and age, there's so many other options. Why would you settle for that?
Well, let's talk about Kanye West for a second, because I know it's sort of old news at this point, but Jay Leno really did get almost suspiciously lucky to have him as one of his first guests. Now,
he had him booked for him as a musical guest weeks in advance.
Yeah, but just the fact, though, that then Kanye pulled his stunt at the VMAs the night before, it was like almost guaranteed to get even higher ratings for Leno.
And you should explain what that stunt was.
Yeah, the fact that he got up and he took away Taylor Swift's moment when she won like best lead female vocal or whatever and said that, you know, basically said that Beyonce deserved it better because she had the best video all year.
So you think Kanye made a fool of himself on the Video Music Awards so he could help Jay Leno in the ratings?
Well, it's not like it's the first time he's done it.
Not to help Jay Leno.
Well, I'm just saying that it's a possibility that he probably didn't care anymore about his image because he does this at every single award show he goes to. And maybe they paid him extra or something. I'm not saying I believe it, but I think it's intriguing.
I would say if it was set up, it was set up by MTV rather than NBC.
Uh-huh.
I think it was much more because MTV always likes those sort of flashy talk about moments at their award shows. So I think that would be much more likely.
But look how good it was for her career. Great things for Taylor Swift's career. It had to.
Taylor Swift is the best-selling artist of the last 3 years. She doesn't need help in her career.
Okay, but she's getting
sold more records.
She doesn't need help.
No, she doesn't need help. She's the top-selling artist of the last 3 years. She doesn't need a boost by having Kanye insult her.
Did any of you see Kanye's moment there with Jay Leno?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was kind of awkward.
Well, he almost cried, too. And I thought that it was almost sort of a low blow when Jay talked about, well, what do you think your mother would have thought? It was like, whoa.
What I did like about that whole moment, though, was I watched it last night again, just in preparation for today's show. I was watching how the musical number that came afterwards, where Kanye West performed with Jay-Z and Rihanna, how slowly he kind of became himself again through performing, that he really came to life while performing, but while being interviewed, he could barely speak.
I thought it took him a while to come out of the emotional place that Jay had put him in. I did see that.
Now, in television news, was this a big deal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when anything happens that's sort of unscripted, that's, you know, I think that's really where TV succeeds now. And it's just like, because everybody, it's a shared experience. And it's like, oh my God, did you see that? And especially with TV, because it happens in your living room. And when you have the internet now, where if you missed it the first time, it's going to be on YouTube within half an hour. So that just sort of blows these things up even bigger than they ever have been before.
I was a little shocked that there weren't so many surprises. 30 Rock and Mad Men won again. You know, I just, looking at the list of winners, I just can't really see anything where I went, I didn't expect that.
The Emmy, you know, they always seem to nominate the same people over and over. And I can't remember, it was somewhere once where it was a game show. And it was like, name as many of the actors nominated for a Best Actor Emmy in the 90s. And for the Best Actor Emmys in the 90s, for comedy actors, that's like, you think, 5 nominees over a decade. That's 50 possible nominees. There was only 13 over the entire decade. 13 people who kept getting nominated over and over again.
Didn't somebody at some point make the suggestion that after someone's been nominated like 3 times, they can't ever again or something like that?
Or when they win 3 times.
I think there's a lot of politics, though, because a lot of times I don't think people win for the year they're supposed to, but they're just like, oh, this might be our last time to give it to them, so we'll give it to them now.
Oh, it's just like the Academy Awards in that regard.
Yes.
Hasn't Jeff Probst won before as the host of Survivor?
I believe so. Wasn't last year, I think, the first year that they had the reality show host?
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
Amazing Race won the Best Reality Show Emmy Award, and that
they win every year.
They win every year.
Yeah, 7 years in a row.
Finally, after 7 years, I saw my friend Jarrett Carson take the stage. I mean, he's been up there every year, and because there's like 900 different producers to that show, I can never see him. And last night, I saw him walk up on stage he's got these Emmy Awards are like doorstops at his house at this point.
Sperling, are you name dropping?
Yeah, Jarrett Carson, the one of the many producers of Amazing Race. That's a name dropping? Wow, okay.
it's tiresome. I know it's a logistically challenging show, but I really thought Idol deserved to win this year. It's a live show. It had great talent this year. It made tons of news. It was interesting and dramatic, and you know, it deserves to win. It's the number one show in the country for the past, 7-8 seasons. It deserves to win.
Toss it a bone.
Yeah, I think people get kind of lazy, and it's like, I have a feeling a lot of times that category just gets overlooked. They don't do the proper research looking into it, and it's like, well, they won last year. They must still be good. I'll vote for them, this year.
They even won the year they had the stupid family, where they had the group, they can't not lose.
I'm surprised that Jon Hamm or some of the other actors from Mad Men didn't win.
At the same time, I can't really argue against Bryan Cranston or, Glenn Close winning.
Good point.
So it's a little hard to.
Yeah, I think Mad Men is more of a writer's show than it is an actor. It's not that I don't think the actors do a great job, but I think the writing in it is really spectacular.
I don't know. Bryan Cranston won last year. I think Michael C. Hall was overdue. Hugh Laurie should have won 4 or 5 years ago. You know, they just, once they get onto someone, they just keep winning them again and again.
Take them off, right? Take them off.
Yeah. Alec Baldwin again for, you know, 30 Rock.
Well, and Matt Weiner took the stage both for the writing category, which he won for Mad Men, and the best drama series. And I thought what he said was somewhat interesting. He said that, you know, in an age where everything is changing and everything's moving towards the internet, he was just happy to be there and happy to be invited. And it dawned on me as I was listening to him say that one, these are awards only for the US. So at this point, those barriers are being broken down. I watched every single Jay Leno show this week online. I didn't watch them.
So did I.
On the television. Brill, do you find yourself and some of your contemporaries writing about television, do you find them watching more online and less on television?
I don't. The thing is, I don't like watching things on a small screen. And when I do watch television online, I tend to hook it up to my TV so that I can still stream it. I do find myself watching TV on demand a lot more, especially since like NBC's primetime, everything they put immediately on demand that I don't even bother setting my DVR for any of their programming anymore.
Well, certainly some of the online world is coming into television. Jay Leno has this whole segment where he races a Ford Focus around a track with celebrities in it, which is, you know, it's a takeoff of something that was done on Top Gear, which is a British television show. But it's also like overt product placement.
Well, that's sort of the legacy of Ben Silverman with NBC. It's just, you know, attach product and to anything and everything. And I really don't have a problem with it if they're transparent about it. I think because, you know, TV has always been a vehicle for advertising, and there was always, you know, shows sponsored by a company. And I don't have a problem with it as long as it's very overt. I do have problems with things where like shows are developed around a product to sell a product, which I, as I recall, was kind of very much evident with Knight Rider last year, and also My Own Worst Enemy had a lot of it as well.
Do you think that Ben Silverman was before his time or completely off base?
I don't. I think Ben Silverman took it too far.
Well, Brill, before we let you go, is there one big takeaway from last night's Emmy Awards?
No, I don't think so. I think overall it is a nice, pleasant memory. And I think that's exactly what award shows need to be right now, is just not something, oh my God, why did they still air these? That was 3 hours or 3+ hours of my life that I'll never get back. I think it was much better to be like, oh, okay, that was kind of fun.
Well, we certainly thank you for joining us here to talk about the Emmy Awards today. Listeners, if they want to follow you, can do so by following ZapToItBrill on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
And that is correct.
And you're so big, you have two Twitter accounts. You have LA Brill and ZapToItBrill. Is there one that you prefer people follow?
ZapToItBrill is my work account, so you will get all of my feelings about TV from that one. My other account is my personal account, so I really talk about food all the time.
That's the one I'm following.
Exactly. If you want to know what I'm eating, that's the one to follow.
Well, thank you very much, Brill. I greatly, and I am speaking for Karen and Michael here, but we greatly appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, trying to cram everything into one show, we're going to jump from television and the Emmy Awards to the Toronto Film Festival, which I know, Michael, you were at. And we have two journalists joining us now. Noel Murray is a contributing writer to The Onion's AV Club. He can also be found on Twitter at it's Noel MU, correct?
That's correct.
And we also have David Poland, who was on previously. He is the editor and founder of Movie City News. He was also in Toronto. You had a lot of good video come out of Toronto.
13 hours of interviews.
I love the shot of Steven Soderbergh's shoe.
Well, you know, Steven won't do on-camera interviews anymore because he doesn't like to be seen. He doesn't like to be bothered in the streets of New York. So it's like, okay, Steven, can we shoot your feet? And he liked the idea, and so we did it.
Overall, what did you guys think of this year's festival, Noel?
It was fine. I mean, I think fine's the word I kept hearing more than anything. I mean, I think the main story maybe coming out of Toronto was the lack of a story. I mean, there was no kind of surprise bubbling up the way, you know, Juno 2 years ago or Slumdog last year. I don't think that the Oscar race was transformed by this year's Toronto. I don't think that the best of the decade list, you know, was transformed by any means by this year's Toronto. But it was fine. I saw much fewer, you know, really, really, you know, want to walk out bad movies this year. But I saw maybe only three or four things that I, you know, took to heart.
What were they?
The four movies that I actually had on my top tier were The Coen Brothers, A Serious Man, A Prophet, the Jacques Audiard French film about the prisoner rising through the ranks in the French prison, Mother, Bong Joon-ho's strange little murder mystery, and the documentary Videocracy, an Italian documentary about the strangeness that is Italian television.
Well, yeah, and I was really surprised that a lot of the films that people liked, and Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them were in Cannes. Mother was in Cannes, A Prophet was in Cannes, Antichrist was in Cannes. It seemed like it was the Cannes Film Festival transplanted to Canada and shown in Toronto.
I mean, certainly there's more than that, but the problem is you're seeing this now at film festivals everywhere, not just the big ones. Sundance had a lot more stuff that came from Toronto last year. Cannes had more stuff that came from Sundance this year. Toronto had more stuff from Cannes and from Sundance. There's really a dearth of product, particularly English language product. And what I think you're seeing at all these film festivals is a quick increase of how many foreign language films are dominating these festivals and how few American films, particularly ones without distribution, mean much of anything.
Well, you know what's funny is that, I don't know if it's funny, but 2 years ago in Cannes, James Gray, who had directed the film Two Lovers, was conducting a press conference, and he said at the time, and I probably should have just paraphrased him and taken credit for it, but he said that 30 years from now, we'll look back at this time in cinematic history and view it as we do the 1950s and General Motors and the U.S. auto industry, that it was an industry that dominated the space and just never created anything new. They just put fins on it and said it was a new model and a brand new car. Which is what they didn't.
That coming from a guy who's made the same movie four times.
Well, you know, point taken. But I kind of, when he said that, I went, huh, you know, that's kind of true. Because I don't know whether it's the globalization of the entire world and the entire world's economy, but certainly you see more and more foreign language films in the U.S. and elsewhere. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying it's a good thing, but it is certainly noticeable.
Well, the thing is, the independent business was killed off here a couple years ago, mostly after the studios bought it. Basically, the studios bought the independent business and then overplayed it and then destroyed it. So now we're in a very bad period of time for American independent film. And the foreign language films are continuing to do pretty much what they've done. They had major financing issues in the last few years, but they've kind of overcome them, and they're making a lot of small films. To me, the whole, you know, screed that we hear about how terrible Hollywood is, and it's, you know, the nightmare of Hollywood repeating itself over and over again, always same as it ever was. I mean, it's always been an entertainment money business. It's always been a business first and art second. And, you know, the period from 1969 to 73 that we all drool over, you know, was a circumstance in which the business had broken down. And so they really, there was nobody in charge. And that's kind of came out of that. Plus you had the Vietnam War, which is very influential on all that stuff. Nothing horrible has changed. You look back at 1939, much as we love that year, there was plenty of crap that year too. We just don't ever see any of it.
Well, there was probably more of it. They made more films back then.
I will say this, though. I've always had the impression that when you're talking about film festivals, that Sundance tends to be more script-driven and Cannes tends to be more about visuals and trying to do something interesting with the form. And Toronto gets, you know, a little bit of both. And I found that this year, the films tilted a little bit more towards the Sundance side. I felt like there was much more kind of concern with narrative film and sort of straightforward, I'm putting in air quotes here, quality script writing, and much less kind of innovation with either the visual style or the storytelling style.
Well, in the middle of the week, you mentioned on Twitter that you were going to see Vincere, which I'm probably mispronouncing, which is the Italian film about Benito Mussolini and his illegitimate son. I thought it was okay. I thought, you know, it kind of got a little repetitive toward the end.
Yeah, I mean, I actually would agree with you that it's repetitive towards the end. I mean, when she's stuck in the when Benito Mussolini's secret wife is stuck in the mental institution, I mean, those sequences kind of go on, and they just kind of say the same thing over and over again. But what I'm talking about, you know, dynamic visual style, I mean, that movie's got it in spades. I mean, he's doing a combination of stock footage, on-screen titles, overtly operatic stuff where there's characters, you know, talking to each other across the room and their voices are rising, and it's dialogue, but it's actually scored to opera and it sounds like opera. I mean, that kind of stuff is just viscerally exciting, and that's the sort of thing that kind of gets my blood pumping. So even though it kind of tailed off towards the end, to me, Vincere was an example of a movie that was actually trying something, fairly daring and pulling it off for the most part.
What about another film that was at the festival, an Italian film called I Am Love with Tilda Swinton, which also had sort of a Visconti operatic flair to it? It was certainly crafted beautifully.
I missed that one, but I heard good things about it.
Yeah, I missed it too. The other big problem with Toronto this year that was, I think, disastrous for independent film in general was that it was the most front-loaded festival I've ever been to in my life. They now have a full day of press screenings on Thursday, but none after the second Thursday. So the opening day, before the movie festival even opens, the press has started, and it's basically over by Monday. And so there's so much product to see that you kind of have to see whether to meet your editor's needs or to, because it's high profile or because you're doing interviews or whatever. A lot of the stuff that's more interesting, like the Tilda Swinton movie, for instance, which she produced, it's very hard to see it and get through everything else. And as I say, the festival, the second half of the festival's programmed almost as though it's a poke in the face to tell you that, you know, you've missed everything. Now we're going to give you the stuff from Canada that you don't really want to see.
Yeah, the best year I was there was 2007, where they had press screenings after 9, yeah. And everything showed twice, and the films were amazing. I mean, you know, that was just a wonderful year. Last year, they kind of started this thing of front-loading everything, only screening films once, and counter-programming like crazy, where you basically have two films that you absolutely have to see, and they're screening at the same time. So you've got to find a way to get into a public screening, or they had a lot more, I think, private press screenings this year, where they actually had booked a screening room somewhere in Toronto and showed it to 30 people. You know, that was more in evidence this year. So
at least
I agree.
At least a quarter of the interviews I was pitched on were for movies that had not shown yet at the festival. They wanted to do the interviews before they showed the movie.
That's just crazy.
At a film festival? Really? Are you kidding?
Yeah, this is my first year at Toronto, and I stayed through Friday morning. I would have stayed through the end, but I had to be in New York. And by Wednesday, I felt like they were telling me to get out of town. The press office was closing down early. The outdoor Wi-Fi cafe for journalists was dark and shut down at 6 p.m. And I'm trying to file a story in the dark outside on a cold balcony at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. And I'm thinking, aren't there 3 days left for the festival? Why are they treating the journalists like we should be gone already?
Yeah. And the panic, I mean, one of the experiences I had this year was there are a lot of British films this year, a lot of, as I say, films, even in English, films from overseas that, you know, used to be picked up by a lot of these smaller distributors that weren't getting picked up this year. And there was real panic come Sunday and Monday from these people where they were desperate to get any attention they could because they've been so overwhelmed by Up in the Air and A Serious Man and all these, you know, strong, high-profile movies that they were just looking for even a gasp of air. And even the distributors were gone by then. So it was like, I mean, Toronto, I'm sure, is under a lot of pressure from the distributors and the producers to, you know, they want their slots in that first weekend. That's when the heat is. But if Toronto would just say, hey, we're a serious film festival, we need to have things on Wednesday and Thursday of the second week as well, it would force journalists to stay longer, it would force distributors to stay longer, and it really hurts everybody except for the films that already have distribution, which dominate those first 3 or 4 days. I mean, it's not cheap for journalists to be sent there, and there was a lot of cutting back this year. You could see a lot fewer people there. But at the same time, you know, there's a reason it's going on, and if you can't cover it properly, it kind of sucks.
Well, and, you know, I can't tell you the number of times in Canada, Michael, I'm sure you've experienced this, where you go up to an important film, you go up to the publicist, and they say, oh, well, you know, we're going to be doing press back in the States. You can cover it then. And I've had to really, really fight over the years to get into some of those films and cover them because, you know what? I didn't fly all the way to Cannes to cover it back in Los Angeles. The story is in Cannes at that point, and likewise for Toronto, the story is in Toronto, the fact that it is a premiering film in Toronto.
with Toronto, there's such a wide berth of stuff that you kind of, the truth is a lot of stuff, as I say, I filmed 13 hours of interviews at wow. Toronto. So a lot of that is not going to be relevant to anybody but me and the filmmakers who are involved till 3 months from now, 6 months from now, whatever it is, when they get distribution or whatever. You know, yes, I have Ellen Page, the movie's out, you know, open in 3 weeks. Yes, that's going to be popular. But, you know, when you go to Toronto, when you go to Cannes, when you go to Sundance, you're building a library of information, of interviews, or everything else that should last you, you know, a year and a half.
That's true. A lot of people bank interviews.
You know, I am friends with Tilda Swinton on some level and don't have the chance to even see her or go to, you know, see her movie or do anything else because I can't do it because there's so much other crap I have to do in the same 3 days.
Now, Karen, that's name dropping. You see, he used an A-list actress. That's name dropping.
Yeah, that's much better name dropping. That's much more impressive. Well done.
I
thank you.
she spotted me for name dropping the name of a producer on The Amazing Race. Now, Noel, I'm looking at your scorecard here. You gave a B+ to Antichrist and Youth in Revolt. Now, you also saw The White Stripes Under Great White Northern Lights, which their concert film. They kind of toured Canada. Did anybody else see that? Noel, what did you think of it?
James Roeke saw it as well and was a big fan of it. I liked it quite a bit. It's not really a concert film. That's really my only complaint. It's more of a tour documentary. So you combine these really dynamic, exciting. I mean, the White Stripes are like, you know, maybe one of the top 10 most exciting live rock and roll bands, you know, working right now. Yes. You know, maybe in the top 50 ever. So you know, the live performance stuff is just absolutely phenomenal. But then it's intercut with lots of scenes of, you know, sitting around in the back of a car, you know, riding on a plane, your standard kind of tour documentary stuff. There is a little bit more kind of insight into Jack White's writing process and his philosophy of music making, which I find really fascinating. And the thing looks astonishing. I mean, it's like one of the best looking rock and roll films I've ever seen. I mean, it's got this stark black and white and stark red and white sequences. They kind of combine color and black and white in a really striking way. But I wish it had been a little bit more music. That's my only real complaint. The last scene, by the way. I'm sorry,
Rocky liked it so much that he went back a second time during the festival.
Yeah, I don't blame him because it's probably the best chance to see it on a big, big screen, you know, with it blowing you out the back of the theater as opposed to, you know, it's going to find its home on DVD, you know. And there is actually, to be fair, there actually is a White Stripes concert DVD called Under Block Pool Lights. So if you want the full White Stripes concert experience, it's available already. But, you know, nevertheless, I wish there had been a little more music.
I would have loved to have seen that, but again, it conflicted with five other things, and it just wasn't possible. And I'm a huge White Stripes fan, so I definitely would have, you know, done anything to be able to do it. But the lack of repeating of screenings and the lack of the front loading really made a problem this year.
I also like the Neil Young Trunk Show, which was another concert movie by John Demme.
I didn't care for that one.
You didn't care for that one?
No, I there wasn't a whole lot of Jonathan Demme in there. I mean, my impression was that it was a bunch of footage that that Neil Young got with his own crew and that Demme kind of cut it together. I didn't feel a whole lot of Demme in it. And the set list to me was not prime Neil Young. I mean, it was, you know, when the fourth song in the set is a 20-minute track from Crone Dreams 2, you know, it kind of wore me down, to be honest. And I'm a huge Neil Young and Jonathan Demme fan, and that one kind of left me cold.
Well, one of the half hours we have is John Demme talking about making the movie, so we'll fix that problem. But okay. I thought it was very interesting and very, you know, it was almost the opposite number to the last Demme Neil Young movie, I thought.
Now, have you seen Neil Young live recently? Because that's pretty much his entire live set is, you know, here's a bunch of songs you don't know, and we'll end on four that you do.
Yeah, it's probably an accurate document of what Neil Young is like right now. It might have been hampered by the fact that I saw it in the live outdoor screening, which I was standing in a crowd of people, standing up for like 2.5 hours, so it was a little bit exhausting, you know, seeing
and probably
it that
being
way.
Screened off a DVD.
Yes, absolutely. It was not like it was gorgeous looking by any means.
The other thing that was interesting to me about that show, that movie, and a few other things was that there does seem to be a movement now where documentary is kind of becoming completionist because there's so much, you know, there's so many cameras out there that you get a sense that Neil Young's entire life can, you know, spread out in front of you. And every year's concert, whatever, you know, new idea he has, John Demme is going to be there and make a movie in 3 days. And a lot of films that felt like, you know, it was thrown together because we could. But there's something interesting and joyous about that.
Now, speaking of documentaries, I noticed, Noel, you gave Capitalism, A Love Story a C+. That's Michael Moore's new film. Of course, a controversial documentary filmmaker and now, of course, probably more famous than many of his films.
I thought that, you know, certain passages of it were you know, some of Michael Moore's best and most persuasive stuff. I mean, like, there's a sequence where he talks about a privatized juvenile detention facility in Pennsylvania. And I don't know whether the anecdote about that facility really makes the case that capitalism is inherently morally bankrupt, but it does make the case that everyone who says that private is inherently better to public, you know, this is a very good counterargument. So there's a lot of that stuff in the film that I thought was very exciting, but it was all very shapeless, you know, and a lot of it seemed like it was just him reading yesterday's headlines and in a snide voice. I mean, if you watch The Daily Show, you know, if you read political blogs, there's not much information in this film that you haven't already gotten. It's just in this case, you're getting it from Michael Moore, and that's supposed to make it somehow, you know, more important and more interesting. And, you know, I do find the guy off-putting. I agree with a lot of what his sentiment is, but I really, there's quite often many times where I'd rather he not be the main spokesman for my side.
Like, I actually have no problem with him being the person saying it. My problem with this movie, and I don't like the movie, is that Michael... It's even more so than Fahrenheit 9/11. It's a movie about what Michael wants to say and not about anything close to documentary filmmaking. There's not a single idea in it that is basically not him saying, this is what I think and here's how I'm going to illustrate that I'm right. Whether or not it makes sense, whether or not there's a balanced argument, he doesn't actually make any balanced arguments, because even the core premise of the movie, that something is wrong with capitalism, the whole movie is about how capitalism worked for America. Then the Republicans came and it didn't work for America. Now capitalism is going to save us.
He doesn't really do the legwork, does he? I mean, he doesn't have very many interviews with anybody who's not, you know, a person getting thrown out of their house, or his own Catholic priest, or Wallace Shawn. I mean, he doesn't really interview anybody who's an actual decision maker. You know,
there's so much found footage in this film. The only movie that you can compare it to in his group of films is Fahrenheit. And Fahrenheit was a much more specific film. I thought Fahrenheit, of course, responsible for the second Bush administration, but this movie is just nothing. It's to me, and there was a movie that I loved at the festival that's also by an insane person rambling on, telling their idea of what's going on in America, called Collapse by Chris Smith. And I think that guy, who is clearly a conspiracy theorist nut job on some level, is infinitely more convincing than Michael Moore.
Well, the low point of the movie was definitely Michael Moore bizarrely interviewing Wallace Shawn about economics for no reason whatsoever. Apparently, Wallace Shawn took an economics course sometime in his life. But I remain eternally fascinated that the only people who hate Michael Moore more than the far right is the liberal left. I mean, people just really cannot stand him. People come out of the screening spitting fire. I think it's because he's a sloppy filmmaker, and it annoys people in Hollywood that he does so well.
You know, just to wrap up our Toronto coverage here, I guess I can do something a little different, but I don't know whether you've seen some of the movies I'm about to mention, but if you could just say see it or don't see it, Whip It, the Drew Barrymore directed film.
Shockingly good.
I didn't see it, but my colleague Scott Tobias was mixed.
Didn't see it.
It's a complete goof girl movie, but it's a lot of fun. Not great in filmmaking, but it's a fun movie.
Now, Precious, the film that was named Push up at Sundance and had changed its name by the time it got to Cannes and is now titled Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, it won the top prize at this year's Toronto Film Festival, as it won the top prize at Sundance. Did you guys get a chance to see it at Toronto?
I saw it at Sundance, and I thought it was quite strong, mainly for the performances more than anything else. But yeah, it's definitely a see it.
I think it's the white guilt movie of the year. People just, I don't know, they want to give awards to women who don't wear makeup. Look, it's a celebrity without makeup. To me, that's like half the movie. It's very powerful to watch people in pain. These people are in enormous pain. I'm not impressed with that. I didn't think it was particularly good filmmaking. I think the performances are fine, but not exceptional. I feel like I need to see it again, but at this point, I would say skip it.
Wow. Okay.
I didn't think much of the film either. I thought it was very poor filmmaking, just on a technical level. The performances were okay, but you've got Oprah and Tyler Perry beating the drums for it and winning the top audience award at Sundance and Toronto. It definitely has every opportunity to be the commercial indie breakthrough of the year.
Jennifer's Body, which I think, in my opinion, is probably the one film that was damaged by Toronto this year. It's the second film written by Diablo Cody, who wrote Juno. I think people just hated this film up there. It did not get very good reviews, and of course opened this weekend to poor reviews and poorer box office.
Jennifer's Body is a movie that had nothing to do with critics. Critics had nothing to do with whether it did good or bad. I think Fox missed the boat on it because they sold it to boys instead of girls. And boys don't go to see movies just to see Megan Fox take off her shirt. It's not it, historically, you know, the Jessica Biel, whoever it is, guys won't go to see those movies. So they blew the marketing. It's a horrible movie, badly directed, overly written. The performances are actually okay, but it's a hideous movie.
What about Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans?
That was a Scott one. Scott enjoyed that one.
Guilty pleasure movie of the festival, maybe the most likable film of the entire festival. Completely over the top. Nick Cage eats the scenery like it was his lunch and dinner. and you know, Werner Herzog goes to hog heaven. But all I want to see now is, you know, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Jersey, with Al Pacino chewing his scenery. Because I want to see an entire series of every overactor ever doing a Bad Lieutenant movie after seeing this.
And what about The Informant, film that kind of got mixed reviews when it came out just last week?
Yeah, I actually saw that here in Arkansas. I missed it at Toronto. But I thought that was really terrific. It's interesting that it's actually another Soderbergh formal experiment, although kind of couched in a much more entertaining way than, say, Shay or Girlfriend Experience. I don't know that it's necessarily better than those films, but it's certainly more entertaining than those films. And, you know, I don't know, it's interesting. It fooled me. I mean, I honestly was so caught up in what it was doing with Matt Damon's narration that it really did catch me by surprise when things gradually change about the movie. I don't want to give too much away. But when the situation kind of gradually changes, I was actually fooled in a very, in a good way.
I think it may be one of the great movies of the year. I think it's very Coen-esque in that it's going to take another viewing and some time to really think about it, let it sink in, because it is weird, you know. But you have Matt Damon in a great performance in the lead, very, very funny. And I think it's a terrific movie, actually. I've seen it twice, and I'll be looking forward to seeing it again. So I'm a big fan of that movie.
Well, you said you weren't sure which if it was better than those other movies, but it was more entertaining. And in my book, more entertaining does, in fact, mean it's better.
Is there one takeaway that either of you would want listeners to know about this year's festival?
I would just say that, you know, I love Toronto. It's my favorite of the film festivals that I go to every year. It's you know, such a wonderfully populist experience, and that you can actually rub noses with actual film goers and not just critics. Although I love my critic friends and love seeing them every year. You know, and this year, even though the films were kind of, you know, not quite as exciting as they had been in the past, it's still a very, very well-run festival for the most part. I agree with David that they need to do a little bit better job of spreading out the press screenings, you know. But that's just my own personal complaint. As a festival as a whole, I don't have a whole lot of complaints. I would recommend that anybody who loves movies, you know, you don't have to be a critic. You can buy a package very cheaply, go up to Toronto, and see a bunch of great films.
My takeaway is that festivals are in trouble. Not just Toronto, but all of them across the country. You will see festivals that you were 10 days last year will be 5 days and 6 days this year, because it's a very, very tough business. And my takeaway for people is, if you go to a film festival, whether it's Toronto or your local festival, go see the movies that don't have distribution. Try something out, because you're going to find stuff that you really love that you didn't expect. And the movies that have distribution are going to turn up in a month or two or six or eight anyway. So really dive into the film festival experience. As professionals, Noel and I don't have the choice of doing whatever we want to do. When we go to a film festival, we have to see certain things. Audiences can go see whatever they want, and they should. That's my take.
Absolutely. I that's why I didn't see movies like The Road and The Informant, because I knew I could see them later, so why bother? And I caught a couple of nice surprises, like Northless, which is a film about an illegal immigrant trying to get from Mexico to California, and a Korean film called A Brand New Life about a little girl who gets dropped off at an orphanage. And both were, you know, happy surprises for me at the festival.
Well, guys, thank you very much. I certainly hope you can both join us again sometime soon.
Sure.
All right, thanks.
Thank you very much. We should probably wrap up some of the other big news. One of the big news items this past week happened at like 5:30 on Friday afternoon after everybody had gone home. It was the fact that Walt Disney Studios chief Dick Cook, who had been with them for 38 years, is leaving the company, or more appropriately, is probably being pushed out of the company by CEO Robert Iger.
Oh, definitely being pushed out.
Yeah.
Yeah, unquestionably.
This is a guy who joined the company as a train driver. He drove one of the monorails at Disneyland.
In 1970.
Yeah, pretty amazing. He said here, I have been contemplating this for some time now and and feel it's the right...
Yeah, what, all of like a minute and a half?
I've been contemplating it all the way back from Robert Iger's office. I feel it's the right time for me to move on to new adventures. I have loved every minute of my 38 years that I've worked at Disney, except for that last 5 minutes in Robert Iger's office. A person close to Cook said the movie chief didn't see it coming. He was summoned into a meeting and was told the studio, quote, wanted to go in a different direction, although a Disney spokesperson denied this report. And quite frankly, I mean, how many times do you hear that? It's almost cliche. I find it hard to believe that's true. I mean, he may not have been expecting it, but the fact that they told him they wanted to go in a different direction, come on.
Yeah, a successful direction.
When I worked at Disney, Dick Cook was a god. Everybody looked up and listened to Dick Cook. He basically, along with Jeffrey Katzenberg, ran the studio.
What is it? Whoa. Jeffrey Katzenberg didn't run the studio. Michael Eisner would object to that.
Well, I mean, on a film basis.
Katzenberg was on the animation. No. He didn't even run the film studio. No, that's not true.
I think you're just getting your egos confused. I mean,
yeah.
But did people like Cook? I mean, did they like respect him and like him as a person?
What's he known for?
They love Cook.
Yeah, what's he known? But what's he known for creatively? What did he do for Disney? What was his?
I always thought he was a number cruncher.
Well, I know that when I was working there, he is definitely a number cruncher, and he did start on the business end of things. But he was working quite a lot on a couple of the films that Nicolas Cage was involved in, also. That Jerry Bruckheimer was involved in. So a lot of the Jerry Bruckheimer films he kind of had a little bit of a hand in, to the point, actually, where in the Los Angeles Times, Johnny Depp says he is, quote, shocked and very sad that his enthusiasm for the fourth Pirates movie, which he committed to starring in just last week, has basically his enthusiasm has waned, he said.
Oh, come on. I really don't. I think that this guy was strictly he was a numbers cruncher. I don't think he was creative at all.
Well, it was because of Cook, according to the Los Angeles Times, that Depp signed on to the first Pirates movie.
Hmm.
And, well, then that's a legacy right there of a couple billion dollars.
Right, and Depp said that when everybody else at Disney was hounding him about the gold teeth in Jack Sparrow's mouth and his body language and his accent.
His behavior.
Yeah, that Dick Cook was the only one that stood up and said, this will work.
Well, there you go. He deserves credit for that.
All right. Well, okay. I mean,
Johnny Depp does not do phoners about executives very often or phone interviews at all, usually. And he was speaking from London, and he says here, when things went a little sideways on the first Pirates movie and others at the studio were less than enthusiastic about my interpretation of the character, Dick was there from the first moment. He trusted me. I mean, he did a very extensive interview with the LA Times on this, which David Poland, and we should have asked him about this, but David Poland said that is a sure sign that he was fired. Because
of course, no. It's at 5 o'clock on Friday. You don't decide to leave at 5 o'clock on Friday. You decide on Monday at 9 a.m. at a lovely press conference. Of course, he was fired. There's no question. I've been thinking.
Still, I wonder what the final straw was.
G-force.
That's as good a reason as any.
Okay, dude, I wanted to see that movie. Okay, I thought that Gerbils.
You'll see gerbils, but you won't see meatballs falling from the. You won't see meatballs
because
falling from
like
the sky.
I like irony and like funny in my cartoons. Gerbils with like their gear.
Giant
meatballs.
Giant meatballs. They're falling
that's
from the
stupid.
Sky.
Stupid. That's whimsical. I don't like whimsical. I like snarky and rude. And that shouldn't surprise you, frankly.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, on that note, I'm going to do a very poor segue of going from basically I think we just lost Michael. I think his battery finally wore out, so we should thank him now. Of course, you can always find Michael at Michael Giltz on Twitter and michaelgiltz.com. That's GILTZ. I'd like to thank all of our guests. Karen, you're KWoody3939 on Twitter. Noel Murray is at Noel MU, M as in Mary, U as in University. David Poland is at David Poland. David Poland, you can also find on Movie City News. Karen, you can find on IndustryNexus.com. Noel Murray can be found on the AV Club. Brill Bundy from ZapToIt.com is where to find her. She's also ZapToItBrill on Twitter. You can also find links to all of our stories the ones we discussed on this episode, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can look them up in the show notes for episode 21. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us with either feedback or comments about the stories we covered, please feel free to add to the conversation. You can do so by emailing dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. If speaking rather than writing is more your thing, you can also leave us a voicemail. You can tell us how wonderful we are or talk about the news stories we are covering or should cover. The phone number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. Of course, you can always submit a link to us through delicious.com, the social bookmarking website. Just make sure to tag your link, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is from the band Management, or MGMT, as they are properly called. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or find them on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT. Well, hopefully Michael makes it home safely. Until next week.
After he gets McNuggets. Sorry, yeah, play nice.
Play nice.